Chapter 7. The First Month Continued. When I first entered the prison, I possessed a small sum of money, but I carried very little of it about with me, lest it should be confiscated. I had gummed some banknotes into the binding of my New Testament, which had been given to me at Tobolsk by someone who had been exiled many years previously, and who was accustomed to regard other unfortunates as his brethren. There are men in Siberia who spend their lives giving brotherly assistance to the unfortunates. They feel the same sympathy for them as they would for their own children. Their compassion is something sacred and wholly disinterested. I cannot help here relating quite briefly an encounter which I had at about this time. In the neighbouring town there lived a widow, Nastasia Ivanovna. None of us, of course, was in direct contact with this woman. She had made it the object of her life to assist all those in exile, and particularly us convicts. Had there been some misfortune in her family? Had someone dear to her suffered punishment similar to ours? I do not know. In any case, she did what she could for us, though it was little enough, for she was very poor. But we felt, when shut up in prison, that we had a devoted friend outside. She often brought us news which we were very glad to hear, for nothing of the kind reached us. When I left the prison to be taken to another town, I had the opportunity of calling upon her and making her acquaintance. She lived in one of the suburbs, at the house of a near relation. Nastasia Ivanovna was neither old nor young, neither pretty nor ugly. It was difficult, impossible even, to know whether she was intelligent and well-bred, but through her actions there shone an infinite compassion, an irresistible desire to please, to solace, to be in some way helpful. All this could be read in the sweetness of her smile. I spent a whole evening at her house with other prisoners. She looked us straight in the face, laughed when we laughed, did everything we asked her, agreed with all we said, and did her best in every way to entertain us. She gave us tea and various little delicacies. We felt sure that she would have enjoyed being rich only in order to entertain us the better and offer us more substantial consolation. When we wished her goodbye, she presented each of us with a cardboard cigar case as a souvenir. She had made them herself, heaven knows how, with coloured paper, the paper with which schoolboys' copybooks are covered. All round this cardboard cigar case she had gummed, by way of ornament, a narrow fringe of gilt paper. "As you smoke, these cigar cases will perhaps be of use to you," she said, as if excusing herself for making such a present. "I have both read and heard it said that love of one's neighbour is only a form of selfishness. What selfishness could there have been in this woman's charity? That I could never understand. Although I had not much money when I arrived at the prison, I could never feel seriously annoyed with men who, after borrowing and letting me down in the first few days, expected me to lend a second, a third time, and even oftener. What I did not like was the thought that these people, with their smiling knavery, took me for a fool and laughed at me just because I lent money for the fifth time. I must have seemed to them a veritable dupe. If, on the contrary, I had refused and sent them away, I am certain that they would have had much more respect for me. Still, though it vexed me very much, I could not refuse them. I was rather anxious during the first days to discover where I stood, and to decide what rule of conduct I should follow in my relations with others. I felt and perfectly understood that, the place being in every way new to me, I was walking in darkness, and that it would be impossible to live 10 years in darkness. I decided to act frankly, according to the dictates of my conscience and personal feeling. But I also realized that while this decision might be all very well in theory, I should in practice be guided by events as yet unforeseen. Therefore, in addition to all the petty annoyances caused to me by my confinement, one terrible anguish laid hold of me and tormented me more and more. "The house of the dead," I said to myself, as night fell and watched from the doorway of our barrack the prisoners just come from work walking about the courtyard, passing between the kitchen and the barracks. As I studied their movement and their faces, I tried to guess what sort of men they were and what their dispositions might be. They lounged about there, some with lowered brows, others full of gaiety. One of these two expressions was seen on every convict's face, exchanged insults or talked of trivialities. Sometimes, too, they wandered about alone, apparently occupied with their own reflections, some of them with a worn-out, pathetic look, others with the conceited air of superiority. Yes, here, even here, caps balanced on the side of their heads, their sheepskin coats flung picturesquely over their shoulders, insolence in their eyes and mockery on their lips. Here is the world to which I am condemned, in which, despite myself, I must somehow live, I said. I endeavoured to question Akim Akimitch, with whom, for the sake of company, I liked to take my tea, for I wanted to know something about the different convicts. In parenthesis, we may say that tea was almost my only nourishment in the early days of my imprisonment. Akim Akimitch never refused to share it with me, and he himself heated our tin samovars, which were made in prison and hired out by M. Akim Akimitch generally drank a glass of tea. He had glasses of his own, calmly and silently, and thanked me and at once went to work on my blanket. But he had not been able to tell me what I wanted to know, and could not even understand my desire to know the characters of the men around me. He merely listened with a cunning smile which is still vivid in my memory. No, I thought, I must find out for myself. It is useless to interrogate others. Early on the morning of the fourth day, the convicts were drawn up in two ranks in the courtyard before the guardhouse, close to the prison gates. Before and behind them were soldiers with loaded muskets and fixed bayonets. A soldier has the right to fire on any convict who tries to escape, but he is answerable for his shot if there is no absolute necessity to open fire. The same thing applies to mutiny. But who would think of openly taking to flight? The engineer officer arrived accompanied by the so-called conductor and some non-commissioned officers of the line, together with sappers and soldiers told off to superintend the work. The roll was called, and the convicts who were going to the tailor's shop were marched off first. These men worked inside the prison and made clothes for all the inmates. Others went to the outer workshops, until it was the turn of those detailed for field labour. I was of this group. There were altogether 20 of us. Behind the fortress on the frozen river were two government barges. They were useless and had to be broken up so that the timber might not be lost. This timber was itself almost worthless, for firewood can be bought in the town at a nominal price, the whole countryside being covered with forests. The work was simply intended to give us something to do, as was understood on both sides, and accordingly we went to it apathetically. Things were very different when there was a useful job or some definite scheme to be carried out. In that case, although the men themselves derived no profit, they tried to get it done as soon as possible and took a pride in doing it quickly. But when the labour was a matter of form rather than of necessity, no high-powered effort could be expected. We had to work until the 11 o'clock drum told us to cease. The day was warm and foggy. The snow was on the point of melting. Our group walked towards the bank behind the fortress, our chains rattling beneath our garments. The sound was clear and ringing. Two or three convicts went to collect tools from the depot. I walked ahead with the others, rather excited, for I was anxious to discover in what this field labour consisted, to what sort of work I was condemned, and how I should do it for the first time in my life. I remember the smallest particulars. As we walked along, we met a townsman with a long beard, who stopped and slipped his hand into his pocket. One man fell out, took off his cap, and received alms to the extent of 5 kopecks, then hurried back. The townsman made the sign of the cross and went his way. Those 5 kopecks were spent the same morning in buying scones of white bread, which were shared equally amongst us. Some of my squad were gloomy and taciturn, others indifferent and indolent. There were some who kept up a perpetual chatter. One of them was extremely gay, heaven knows why. He sang and danced as we went along, shaking and ringing his chains at every step. He was a huge, fat man, the same who, on the day of my arrival at washing time, had quarrelled with one of his companions about the water, and had ventured to compare him to some sort of bird. His name was Skuratov. He finished by shouting out a lively song of which I remember the burden. They married me without my consent when I was at the mill. Nothing was wanting but a balalaika. His extraordinary good humour was justly reproved by several of the prisoners who took offence at it. "Listen to his row," said one of the convicts. "Why can't he shut up? The wolf has but one song, and this Tuliak is stealing it from him," said another, whose accent proclaimed him a Little Russian. "Of course I'm from Tula," replied Skuratov, "but we don't stuff ourselves to bursting as you do in Pultava." "Liar! What did you eat yourself? Bark shoes and cabbage soup?" "You talk as if the devil fed you on sweet almonds," broke in a third. "I admit, my friend, that I'm softly nurtured," said Skuratov with a gentle sigh, as though he were really reproaching himself for his softness. "I was lapped in luxury from earliest childhood, fed on plums and dainty cakes. My brothers even now have a large business at Moscow. They're wholesale dealers in the wind that blows, immensely rich men, as you may imagine."
"And what did you sell?"
"I was very successful. And when I received my first 200
rubles?
"Impossible," interrupted one of the prisoners, struck with amazement at hearing of so large a sum.
"No, my good fellow, not 200 rubles, 200 strokes. Luka, I say, Luka."
"Some have the right to call me Luka, but to you I'm Luka Kuzmich," retorted a small, feeble convict with a pointed nose.
"The devil take you. You're really not worth speaking to, yet I wanted to be civil to you.
But to continue my story, this is how it happened that I left Moscow. I received my last 15 strokes and was then sent off, and was at—"
"But what were you sent off for?"
asked another convict, who had been listening attentively.
"Don't ask stupid questions. I was explaining to you how it was I did not make my fortune at Moscow. And yet you can't imagine how anxious I was to be rich."
Several prisoners began to laugh. Skuratov was one of those lively persons, full of animal spirits, who take a pleasure in amusing their graver companions, and who, as a matter of course, received no reward except insults. He belonged to a type of men of whose characteristics I shall perhaps have occasion to say more.
"And what a fellow he is now," observed Luka Kuzmich. "His clothes alone must be worth 100 rubles.
Skuratov had the oldest and greasiest sheepskin imaginable. It was patched in many different places, with pieces that scarcely hung together. He looked at Luka attentively from head to foot.
"It's my head, friend," he said. "My head that's worth the money. When I said goodbye to Moscow, I felt that at any rate my head was going to make the journey on my shoulders. Farewell, Moscow. I shall never forget your free air, nor the tremendous flogging I got. As for my sheepskin, you're not obliged to look at it. Perhaps you'd like me to look at your head, if it was really his own natural property, but it was given him in charity," cried Luka Kuzmich. It was a gift made to him at Tumen when the convoy was passing through the town. Skuratov, you had a workshop.
Workshop?
He was only a cobbler, said one of the convicts. It's true, said Skuratov, without noticing the caustic tone of the speaker. I tried to mend boots, but never got beyond a single pair.
And were you paid for them?
Well, I found a fellow who certainly neither feared God nor honoured either his father or his mother, and as a punishment, Providence made him buy the work of my hands.
The group round Skuratov burst out laughing.
I also worked once at the prison, continued Skuratov with imperturbable coolness. I mended boots for Stepan Fyodorich, the lieutenant.
And was he satisfied?
No, my dear fellows, indeed he wasn't. He blackguarded me enough to last me for the rest of my life. He kicked my backside, too. What a rage he was in. Ah, my life's been a failure. I see no fun whatever in prison.
He began to sing again. Akolina's husband is in the courtyard. There he waits. Again he sang, and again he danced and leaped.
Most unbecoming, murmured the little Russian, who was walking by my side.
Frivolous man, said another in a serious, decided tone.
I could not make out why they insulted Skuratov, nor why they despised those convicts who were light-hearted, as they seemed to do. I attributed the anger of the little Russian and the others to a feeling of personal hostility, but in this I was wrong. They were vexed that Skuratov had not that puffed-up air of false dignity with which the whole prison was impregnated. They did not, however, disapprove of all the jokers, nor treat them all like Skuratov. Some of them were men who would stand no nonsense, and neither forgive nor forget. It was necessary to treat them with respect. One of these fellows was a good-natured, lively type, whom I did not see in his true colours until later on. He was a tall young man with pleasant manners, and not without good looks. His face, too, wore a comic expression. He was known as the Sapper, because he had served in the engineers. He belonged to the special section. But all the serious-minded convicts were not so particular as the little Russian who could not bear to see people gay. There were several prisoners who wished to be thought superior, either by virtue of their manual skill, of their general ingenuity, of their character, or of their wit. Many of them were intelligent and energetic, and achieved what they desired, a reputation for preeminence, that is to say, and the enjoyment of moral influence over their companions. They often hated one another, and were envied by the remainder of their fellow prisoners, upon whom they looked down with an air of dignity and condescension, never deigning to quarrel without good cause. Enjoying the favour of officialdom, they exercised some measure of authority at the place of work, and none of them would have lowered himself so far as to quarrel about a song. These men were most polite to me throughout my imprisonment, though by no means communicative. At last we reached the river bank. A little lower down lay the old hulk, which we were to break up, stuck fast in the ice. On the other side of the water was the blue steppe and the sad horizon. I expected to see the whole party set to work. Nothing of the kind happened. Some immediately sat down casually on logs of wood that lay near the bank, and nearly all took from their pockets pouches of native tobacco which was sold in leaf at the market at the rate of 3 kopecks a pound, and short wooden pipes. They lighted them, while the soldiers encircled us, and looked on with obvious boredom.
"Who the devil had the idea of sinking this barge?" asked one of the convicts in a loud voice, without addressing anyone in particular. "Were they very anxious, then, to have it broken up?"
"The people were not afraid to give us work," said another.
"Where are all those peasants going to work?" said the first, after a short silence.
He had not even heard his companion's answer, and was pointing to the distance, where a troop of peasants were marching in file across the virgin snow. All the convicts turned slowly in that direction, and began from mere idleness to
to laugh at the peasants as they approached. One of them, the last of the line, was the source of particular amusement. He walked with his arms apart, his head on one side, and wore a tall, pointed cap. His shadow was cast in clear outline on the white snow.
"Look at Petrovich," said one of my companions, imitating the local accent. Oddly enough, the convicts looked down on the peasants, although they were for the most part peasants themselves. "Look at that fellow on the end. He looks as if he were planting radishes."
"He's an important chap. He has lots of money," said a third.
They all began to laugh, without, however, seeming genuinely amused. Meanwhile, a scone seller had approached. She was a brisk, lively person, and it was with her that the 5 kopecks given by the townsmen were spent. The young fellow who sold white bread in the prison took 2 dozen of her scones, and then tried beating down the price. She would not, however, agree to his terms. At this point, the sergeant in charge arrived, cane in hand.
"What are you sitting down for? Get on with your work."
"Detailers off, Ivan Matveitch," said one of our so-called foremen as he slowly got up.
"You know your jobs. Dismantle that barge and quick about it."
At last, the convicts rose and made their way slowly down to the river. Instructions now fell thick and fast. The barge, it seemed, was not to be actually broken up. The skeleton of the hull was to be left intact, and this was not an easy thing to manage.
"Pull this beam out, that's the first thing to do," cried one convict, a mere navvy who knew nothing whatever about it.
This man, very quiet and a little stupid, had not previously spoken. He now bent down, took hold of a heavy beam with both hands, and waited for someone to help him. No one, however, seemed inclined to do so.
You'll never manage it. Not even your grandad the bear could do it," muttered someone between his teeth. "Well, chum, are we going to make a start? I can't carry on alone," said the other morosely, and he stood upright. "Well, what's the hurry unless you're going to do the whole job on your own?"
"I was only making a remark,"
said the poor fellow, excusing himself for his forwardness.
"Must you have blankets to keep yourselves warm, or do you want to be otherwise heated this winter?"
bellowed a corporal at the 20 men who seemed loath to begin work.
"Get on with it at once."
"It's never any use being in a hurry, Ivan Matveitch."
"Look here, Savilyev, you're doing nothing at all. What are you looking about for? Are your eyes for sale by any chance? Come along now."
"But I can't do the work single-handed."
"Tell each of us what to do, Ivan Matveitch."
"I told you before that I have no special task to give you. Get to work on the barge, and when you've finished we'll go home. Get on with your work, I tell you."
The prisoners began work, but without much vigour or goodwill, and the sergeant in charge was understandably furious. While the first rivet was being drawn, it suddenly snapped.
"It broke in pieces," said a convict in self-justification. "Impossible," they all clamoured, "to carry on like this. What was to be done?"
A long discussion took place between the prisoners, and little by little they began to quarrel, nor did this seem likely to be the end of it. The sergeant was yelling and brandishing his cane, but the second rivet snapped like the first. It was then agreed that hatchets were of no use, and that other tools must be procured. Accordingly, 2 prisoners were sent under escort to the fortress to get the proper instruments. Awaiting their return, the others quite calmly sat down on the bank, pulled out their pipes, and began once more to smoke. Finally, the sergeant spat with contempt.
"Well," he exclaimed, "you people won't die from overwork. My God, what a crowd!"
he grumbled ill-humouredly. He shrugged his shoulders and went off towards the fortress, waving his stick. An hour later, the clerk of works arrived. He listened quietly to what the convicts had to say, told them that the job he wanted them to do was only to detach 4 rivets without breaking them and partially dismantle the barge. As soon as this was done, they could go home. The task was not easy, but Lord, how the convicts now set to work! Where now was their idleness, their want of skill? Hatchets began to dance, and the rivets were quickly sprung. Those who had no hatchets made use of thick sticks to push beneath the rivets, and thus, in due time and in artistic fashion, they levered them out. The convicts seemed suddenly to have become intelligent in their conversation, and no more insults were heard. Everyone knew perfectly what to say, to do, and what to advise. Exactly half an hour before the beating of the drum, the appointed task was finished, and we returned to the prison, fatigued, but pleased to have knocked off 30 minutes from the regular working hours. As regards myself, I have only one remark to make. I seemed all the time to be in somebody's way. I was told to get out of the light and generally abused. Any one of the ragged lot, the most miserable, numbskull, ham-handed navvy, who would not have dared to utter a syllable to the other convicts, took upon himself to swear at me if I approached him, under pretext that I interfered with him in his work. At last, one of the better types said to me, frankly but coarsely, "What are you doing here? Clear off. No one asked for your help."
"Hear, hear," added another.
"You'd do better to take a picture," said a third, "and carry water to the building site or go to the tobacco factory. You're no use here."
I was obliged to keep apart. To remain idle while others were working seemed a shame, but when I moved to the opposite end of the barge I was insulted anew.
"A fine crew we've got," they cried. "What can you do with fellows like him?"
Nor was this good-natured fun. They were delighted with the opportunity of scoffing at a gentleman. The listener will now understand why, in those early days, I was at a loss to know how I should ever manage to get on with such people. I foresaw that such incidents would often recur, but I resolved not to alter my line of conduct in any way, whatever the result might be. I had decided to live simply and intelligently, without manifesting the least desire to be on familiar terms with my fellow prisoners, but also without repelling them if they sought my company, to appear indifferent to their hatred and their threats, and to pretend, as far as possible, not to notice them. Such was my plan, for I realized from the outset that they would despise me if I adopted any other course. When I returned to prison in the evening, fatigued and harassed at the end of an afternoon's work, a deep sadness took possession of me. How many thousand days must I pass like this one? That thought was constantly in my mind. Towards nightfall, I was wandering about alone near the palisade at the rear of our barrack, deep in meditation, when I suddenly caught sight of my friend Bull running to meet me. Bull was the prison dog. Every prison has its dog, as companies of infantry, batteries of artillery, and squadrons of cavalry have theirs. He had been here for a long time, belonged to no one, looked upon everyone as his master, and lived on scraps from the kitchen. He was a large black-and-white dog, not very old, with intelligent eyes and a bushy tail. No one ever caressed him or paid the least attention to him, but as soon as I arrived, I made friends with him by giving him a piece of bread. When I patted his back, he stood motionless, looked at me with a pleased expression, and gently wagged his tail. That evening, not having seen me the whole day, me, the first person who in so many years had thought of stroking him, he ran towards me, leaping and barking. I was so deeply moved that I could not help embracing him. I laid his head against my body. He placed his paws on my shoulders and looked me in the face. "Here is a heaven-sent friend," I told myself. And during those first unhappy weeks, my first act on returning from work was to hurry with Bull to the back of the barrack, where he leaped around me with joy. I took his head in my hands and kissed it. At the same time, a troubled, bitter feeling pressed my heart. I well remember thinking, and taking pleasure in the thought, that this was my one, my only friend in the world, my faithful dog, Bull.